Now, Lucy and I have been reading at bedtime the Paddington stories. I don't know if you've ever read them, or maybe you've been one of the many people to go and watch it in the cinema recently. If you haven't read the Paddington stories before, basically every story goes like this. Paddington does something he's never done before. He makes some massive mistakes that lead to hilarious consequences. But in the end, the mistake he makes ends up to a happier ending. So for an example, one we read recently, Paddington's in France riding his bike. He goes down a hill, the bike goes out of control. He ends up accidentally joining the Tour de France and wins the race. That's how things happen for Paddington in the Paddington stories. No matter what happens to him, no matter how bad it gets, there's always a happy ending. Now, in a way, biblical stories are always the same. God's people get into a mess. Sometimes that's a result of suffering in a fallen world. Sometimes that's their own sinfulness. But behind it all, God is at work. And that means no matter what the terrible consequences of their sin may be, it always ends up in a happy ever after. We've seen, if you've been here over the past few weeks, we've seen that things got horrifically bad for Ruth and Naomi. And even more so, if you see the bigger picture of where Israel was at this point, it was even worse. But here is the happy ever after Ruth, Naomi, and Israel have been waiting for. And these stories make a great pattern for our lives, these true stories. Our lives are like Paddington's bike careening down a hill out of control. But through it, God is working for a happy ever after. So let's read the conclusion of this story and see what it teaches us about the happy ever after, not only that came to these women, but the happy ever after that is coming for all God's people. There are three aspects of that happy ever after here. The guardian redeemer will redeem you, the Lord will be praised, and the Son of David will come. First of all, the guardian redeemer will redeem you. And we see that in verses 1 to 10. If you remember 2 weeks ago when I was last here, we learned that Boaz was a guardian redeemer. And that meant that he had the responsibility to purchase the property of his dead relative Elimelech and to marry his son's widow, Ruth. Ruth came to Boaz asking him to fulfill that obligation. And Boaz was quite shocked, really, because he expected Ruth would want to have a younger husband. But he was willing to marry her and thereby lift her out of poverty. However, there was a catch. And the catch was that there was a closer relative than he. And that meant legally Boaz had to offer to that man first. It may seem all rather strange to us, but that was the way things were. And so we left it last time with that level of uncertainty. But as we start the story, we're at the town gate, aren't we? The town gate is where all the important decisions are made at that time. Because it doesn't rain so much in Israel, you can have your town hall outside rather than undercover. And Boaz does everything rightly. He gets the guardian redeemer to come in, makes clear what is available to him. He makes sure he does it in the presence of some of the elders, the leaders of the people. And he first notes the land that is available that should go to the closest living relative. Now, if you know any farmers, extra land generally, if you can get the employment, means extra profit. And so this is an attractive proposition for this man. No wonder. He says, first of all, I will redeem. But then Boaz reveals the other side to this, that if this man buys the land from Naomi, he'll also acquire Ruth the Moabite. If he's going to get the land, the cost is that he must have a responsibility towards this poor dead man's widow. And the problem is significant for that guardian redeemer. It's not just that he has to take up a wife, but it means that he's got to continue the name of a dead man. In our world, we're very focused on our lives, aren't we? So how worthwhile you are as a human being depends on what you achieve in your life, what your CV looks like. But in biblical times, generally, what showed how great you were was what your descendants did. So interestingly, if you look at the book of Genesis, it will introduce the story of Abraham and say, this is the story of Terah, who's his father. And it does the story of Jacob, and it says, this is the story of Isaac. There's a sense in which it's the line that comes after you, which I must say seems a lot more attractive than being evaluated on your own basis. And that's been the case for most of human history. Most people have wanted not only to have a successful life for themselves, but to build one for their children. And I'm sure you could sympathize with that in some way. So for this man, were he to take on Ruth as his wife, any sons he had would not technically be his. They would not continue his family name. And the guardian redeemer says that he can't do this because I might endanger my own estates. Now, he's worried about what this might do to his children and to his own reputation. I think it's noteworthy that this man is never named. Every other important character in this story gets a name, apart from maybe the foreman who speaks to Boaz. This man's quite key, but he's nameless. Because what he does here really is selfish. He's looking out for his own benefit, or at least the benefit of his family. He doesn't do what God requires, care for the widow, care for the foreigner, care for those in need. And so he remains nameless, unnamed, a nobody. There are many people in this world who seem like they're guardian redeemers. Maybe it's political figures, maybe it's preachers, maybe it's those who are giving life advice. But all of them fall short, except for one. Boaz, however, is not that kind of guardian redeemer. When the offer comes to buy this field and to take on the responsibility of Ruth, he does that. He does that by exchanging sandals, which is the way that they dealt with things. We used to shake hands. I'm not sure what we even do nowadays to sign things. Maybe we'll just have to go back to sign on paper. That's another way too. But he exchanges his sandal, and then he makes a public announcement. And the fact it's public is very important. Verse 9. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Today, you are witnesses. Naomi told Ruth last week that Boaz wouldn't rest until he had completed this transaction, and he has done. He has shown that he can be trusted. And just like a wedding today, the important aspect here is not just that Boaz is making these promises, but he's making those promises publicly. On your wedding day, a groom and a bride say to the whole community, we're married now. We're sticking together now. This is it. It's not just a private conversation in a bedroom somewhere. It's public that they will stay together. And that's what Boaz is doing here. He's making a public statement that he can't really back out of. And here Boaz prefigures our guardian redeemer. Boaz had to go through all the rigmarole of the laws of the day to do this by the letter. And Jesus did the same. He kept the law down to the finest margin, and he bore the legal curse that fell upon his people. And that meant our redemption was totally completed. But not only that, it was public. One of the things we don't often think about in the Christian life is what Jesus is doing now. We know that he came, he saved us, and we know that he's going to come back and rescue us, take us to the new perfect world. But what's he doing now? Well, he's interceding for us. That could be quite hard to get our head around. But maybe the illustration of Boaz here gives us a picture of exactly what Jesus does. He stood before the Father He stood before all of the host of heaven, and he's saying, this one is mine. I will not let them go. I have paid for their sin. They are part of my people. And just as firmly as Boaz associates himself to Ruth, so Jesus associates himself with his people before the courts, not of Bethlehem, but of heaven. If he's willing to do that for you, why wouldn't you turn to him? Can there be any greater redeemer than that? And if you're a Christian, you can never doubt the love Jesus has for you. It is public. At a certain point in history, everyone will know that you are his. Just as a bride looks forward to that moment when she is proclaimed as the wife of her future husband, so we should with joy anticipate the way that Jesus will own us as his for all of the universe to see, for all of eternity. So the guardian redeemer will redeem you. Secondly, the Lord will be praised. We'll come back to verses 11 to 12. Let's look for the time being at verses 13 to 17. The Lord will be praised. I said right at the start of this story that there is a big question overriding this book. And the question is God good for his people? Naomi said that the Lord had made her life very bitter. Is the Lord really a bitter God? Is he working for the bad of his people, or is he working for their good? Well, look how our story ends. So Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. Notice, the Lord who was blamed at the start of the story, and he was sovereignly in control, but there is a hint that his control wasn't for good. Here we see that through it all, God has cared for Naomi. He has enabled Ruth to conceive, and she's given birth to a son, which is important because that means he can be a guardian redeemer when Boaz has passed away. So God has been providing for Naomi exactly what she needs. There is a lot of hope built into the story of this son, Obed. The women continue, may he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew you, your life, and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth. This is all spoken of about Obed, because obviously Obed is the only one that has been given birth to by Ruth. And there's this hope that Obed will sustain her in her own age and will become famous throughout Israel, which, as we'll see in a moment, is exactly what happens. But behind all of this, we shouldn't miss the big picture that these women making this prophecy are attributing all the praise, not to Ruth, who certainly is a fantastic woman, worth more than seven sons, or to Boaz, an upstanding guardian redeemer. No, they're saying praise to the Lord, because it is him and him alone that deserves it. It's a bit like if you ever come here for community lunch, we have our lunch and various bits of food are taken from the kitchen out for people to eat. And then at the end, we get the people who've been cooking in the kitchen to come in. They never want to, but we do. And then we reveal, as it were, these are the people that made this event happen. These are the people who made this food. In a sense, we're seeing now the curtain pulled back and seeing who was really in control, who has really brought this happy ever after, God himself. And this praise to God, of course, is not against Naomi's benefit. It is for Naomi's benefit. But God, who deserves praise, is working out a happy ever after for her. The end of history will close in the praise of God as well. If you read the book of Revelation, you might be swayed to look at all of the fantastic prophecies and images, but why not have a look through it sometime and see how many songs there are in Revelation? There are loads of songs, because when history wraps up, there won't be accusations against God. There won't be questions about what were you doing, God? No, there'll be great songs praising God for all he did do for the good of his people. And just like that's not against Naomi's joy, it's not against our joy too. As those famous words say, it's the chief end of man and women to glorify God, to praise him, and to enjoy him forever. Those two things never come into opposition. God being praised for all eternity also means our joy for all eternity. Now, I'm aware that doesn't take away the downward points in our stories. It doesn't take away the times when Naomi had no food. It doesn't take away the times when Naomi felt that life was bitter. But behind it all, God was still at work. And whatever your Naomi-type moments may be, whatever your downward points, if you trust in Jesus, there's a happy ever after coming for you too, where the Lord will be praised. But the final thing we see in this story is the bit that may have seemed to you a bit like a disappointing ending. There's always those times on TV, isn't there, where a series has been built up and everyone's looking forward to finding out the finish, and then there's the big reveal and it seems to fall flat. It may feel that way when we end this story with a genealogy. Exciting stuff. But actually, through this genealogy in verses 18 to 22 and verses 11 to 12 as well, we see that the Son of David will come. The people say this in verse 11 to 12. We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the family of Israel. If you know Genesis, you'll know that Rachel and Leah were the mothers of all the 12 tribes of Israel, or at least the kind of nominative mothers. We won't get into the ins and outs of how exactly that came about, but all the tribes of Israel were descended from these two women. So we're being pointed backwards. And then we carry on in the future. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Again, we're being thrown back into the biblical storyline. Judah had been told by his father Jacob that from him kings would come. Perez was his direct descendant, and from Perez eventually came Boaz, as we see at the end of the story. This genealogy is so important, though it might seem boring. Perez, the son of Judah, prophesied kingly line, was the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Aminadab. Aminadab, the father of Nashon. Nashon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz. Hey up. Boaz, the father of Obed. Obed, the father of Jesse. Do I remember that name, Jesse? Oh, yes. And Jesse, the father of David. Now, I can guarantee, and no matter how unfamiliar you are with the Bible, you've heard of David and Goliath, the great king of Israel. And that's what this story is telling us. It's telling us that throughout this story, a simple story, really, of two women who couldn't feed themselves, a grander narrative is being painted. A story of how God provided David and David's greater son. If you think of genealogies as rather boring, I know this is going to be an illustration that falls flat for some of you, but if you've ever watched Star Wars, maybe think of genealogies a bit like Star Wars. One of the ways that Star Wars introduces shocks in its story is to show, gasp, these characters are related. Now, this is a 40-year-old film, so I think I'm okay for spoilers. But spoiler alert, Luke's father is Darth Vader, the bad bad villain. Shock. And Luke's sister is Princess Leia. Shock. And they've done this in the new ones too, maybe less successfully. It depends what you think about them. But everyone seems to be related to one another. If they're going to be big in the Star Wars universe, they've got to have some relation to Luke Skywalker. They even call it now, I think, the Skywalker Saga or something like that. There is this sense that in that story, you are only important if you're related to this person. And that's the same in the midst of the Bible too. You see, in Eden, when mankind fell, Eve was told that one day she would have a son who would crush Satan. And then we find out that that son is going to be a son of Abraham, a son of Isaac, a son of Jacob, a son of Judah. But then the trail goes cold. Moses foretells a day when there'll be a great king. Judges tells us how bad it was without a king. But as we get to the book of Ruth, we don't know where that kingly line is going to be continued. And yet here we find the story picked up again. A son of Perez, a son of Hezron, a son of Ram, a son of Aminadab, a son of Boaz. Eventually, a son of Jesse, David. Now next week, we're going to go back to Matthew. Matthew is the story of Jesus' life that is most connected to the Old Testament. And it too starts with a genealogy, which is probably why nobody ever gives away copies of Matthew on street corners, because it seems like a really boring beginning. But if you know the Bible, you'll see that that story is being continued. Boaz, Obed, and Ruth, and Jesse, and David all appear in that genealogy. It eventually ends. And Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, and Mary was the mother of Jesus, who is called the Messiah. So from this line, they gave birth to David, was David's greatest son, Jesus. And so through this story, God was not only fulfilling his promises to Naomi, he was doing that, but he was also fulfilling his promises to the people of Israel and all of those who trust in him. That one day there would be a king, a Messiah, who would rule the world forever the way it should be. Therefore, Ruth, Naomi, and Boaz have a better, happy ever after than they could ever imagine. They are part of a story, not just of two women who couldn't find food, but they're part of a story of humanity finding an eternal home with God. And friends, God is still working out that narrative this morning. If you join us tonight, you're going to see exactly what your role is in that plan, the great big plan of God for your life and your place in it. God is redeeming his people through his son. Every element of the universe is working towards that goal. Ruth and Naomi thought this story was about finding food and a husband, but in the end, it was so much bigger. Your life may seem mundane. It may seem you've got an unimportant job, that you're not famous, that you're not going to be remembered in any way beyond your own children or grandchildren. It may seem worse than that. It may seem like your life, like Naomi's, is tragic. But through it all, God is the master story writer. And we are all characters in the great tale he is telling for the universe, which shouldn't scare us, because it ends in a happy ever after that is certain. So as we close this book, we see it isn't the story of Ruth. It isn't even, as I suggested at the start, the story of Naomi. Like all of the scriptures, it is the story of Jesus. Shakespeare famously said, "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women are merely players." And he's right. We're all actors in a great play. But what's the story? Friends, do you realize that the play of this universe always has a happy ever after for those who trust Jesus? Whether it's Ruth or Naomi or you or I, if we are trusting in David's greater son, a happy ever and after will be ours. It's not necessarily a lap a minute Like any good story, there are ups and downs, and we will feel them intensely. But the Redeemer will redeem. The Lord will be praised. The Son of David will come. There can be no doubt. But also, do we see the story of this play does not revolve around you or I? It revolves around someone greater, the Lord Jesus Christ. We each have our part to play, but it's basically being an extra. And that for us is an extraordinarily good thing. Your life story is not your story, it's his story. And that, as it turns out, is a very good thing indeed. If you feel like you're at a down point like now, if you feel like life's never going to get better, like Naomi, you should see that you will have a happy ever after if you are with this guardian redeemer. One final note, though, before we close. If you remember a few weeks ago, Ruth started this story not a part of it. She wasn't one of the good guys. She was really on the side of the bad guys. She was a Moabitess. Yet she chose to unite herself to Naomi. She said, "Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God." It seems like a ridiculous life decision. Turning away from food to a starving woman. Turning away from your people to a people you've never even met. Turning away from your gods who seem to be giving you successful harvests to a God who seems to be constantly punishing his people, whom the woman you are following says has made her life bitter. It seems like the worst decision in the world. And yet look at the ending. Boaz prayed for Ruth earlier in the story. "May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." And wasn't that the case? Under the refuge of God's wings, Ruth was truly rewarded. Perhaps you're here this morning and you're a bit like Ruth. You're on the outside looking in at God's promises. Can I invite you to say this morning, "Your God will be my God." For all the ups and downs of her life, Ruth never regretted that decision. And you won't either. Shelter under the wings of the Lord. And you will find whatever trials you pass through, there is always, always a happy ever after.